Welcome to the Smart Tech Check podcast, hosted by Mark Vina, your home for candid, insightful, and provocative conversations about the smart home, home automation, security, smartphones, PC and console gaming, and much more.
Hi, everyone. My name is Mark Vina, host of the Smart Tech Check podcast. Today is Friday, July 19th, 2024. Joining me for today's podcast are Stuart Walpern, who scribes for Popular Mechanics, AARP, Techlicious, Investopedia, and other fine publications. Rob Peguero, who writes about tech developments at PC Mag, Fast Company, and other publications as well. And good old John Quain, who writes for the New York Times, Smart Cities, and Tom's Guide. Guys, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, it's been a minute.
Yeah.
It's been an adventure. Last week has been an adventure. So many things are even non-tech related that we could talk about. We were going to talk about three other topics, but very quickly want to ping you guys on this whole CrowdStrike. I don't think debacle is an unfair word. For those of you who are flying today, I feel for you because apparently it's been a meltdown at the nation's airports. But Rob, I'm going to just throw it to you for a second. What do you think? Any thoughts?
Just awful. I mean, it's in some ways, it's not a, I don't know if it's an avoidable problem. It's not like there isn't competition. CrowdStrike's on stats, so they have like 17% of the endpoint security market. So there's lots of options, but they are used by so many large companies, which they brag about.
Yes.
And here they had something go wrong that shouldn't have gone wrong, an update to their own software. So it's the ultimate own goal where the what's supposed to be the update to keep your security up current and strong is the thing that takes out the entire system and leaves you with these scenes out of Mr. Robot with people on floors and airports looking up at monitors all showing the Windows blue screen of death.
Well, all I can tell you is that there are legions of stories when your Windows update happens at the worst possible moment and you could be in the middle of a phone call. I mean, I hope it's not something that stupid.
I mean, AI fault. Well, that's what we're going to find out.
So anyway, let me ask you very quickly, any thoughts?
Well, I mean, a system that is vulnerable enough to be taken down by one single incident is not a very well-built system. And I think we've known this for a while, but sometimes it takes a catastrophic event like this to really illustrate just how weak our systems are and how susceptible we are to some sort of a cyber attack. If something can be a self-goal like this by a company who's supposed to be looking out for security, imagine what evil actors might be able to accomplish. I mean, how often do we see that? You know, what happened to AT&T last week? I mean, the systems are just, I don't know what can be done, but it just illustrates their vulnerability, which should be scary to everybody.
Well, and John, I'll just leave this with you, is that, I had my phone on in the middle of the night and the alerts started coming in, there was a problem. My first inclination, because I, tend to be a little bit melodramatic, I guess. Hey, folks, this is Mark Vina, CEO of Smart Tech Research. Smart Tech Research is proud to have Aura sponsoring my Smart Tech Check podcast. Aura security software is the all-in-one digital safety net for the whole family. It's literally like having a personal cyber guardian that protects all of the devices in your home on a 24/7 basis. What's more, its AI functionality stands out as it constantly learns and adapts to threats, keeping your family and you safe around the clock. It's a must-have solution for anyone serious about online security. Stay tuned for a special no-obligation promo offer for Aura that will give you cybersecurity peace of mind.
Hi, I'm Anna with Smart Tech Research. Whether you're browsing the web, checking emails, monitoring your children's online behavior, spam calls and identity protection, and conducting online transactions, Aura has your back, ensuring a secure and seamless experience every time. Aura's comprehensive security solutions are compatible with Microsoft Windows, Apple Mac OS, Android, iOS, and iPad OS devices. For an exclusive 14-day no-obligation trial version of Aura, use the on-screen QR code or visit the website shown here. Aura is the smart, simple way to stay safe online.
Is that, given the fact that the convention ended last night, was this a cyber thing from China? I mean, I could, you know, I don't believe in coincidences, you know, it's a line. I think it's a line from The Godfather, but of course, sometimes it could be complete incompetence, which may be the cause here. But any of your thoughts before we go into the other topics we're about to talk about?
I mean, these updates have triggered lots of network outages before. I mean, there's two levels of discussion for me. One is, you know, the attack vector by everybody using something like Microsoft software, that increases the attack vector. It makes it a huge target. And, you know, maybe that's not a good choice for your business. The same with these cloud services. You won't really only have three, and that's not a good situation to be in either. So much relies on three of them. So again, you know, they didn't sandbox this stuff, which is an obvious, super simple programming technique that one app could take out all this stuff.
That sandboxing
that's pretty bad.
How do you isolate something so it doesn't become a bigger problem?
Right. And that tells you a lot. Like, if you want to be a bad actor, it tells you a lot about how to attack this system. And automated, you brought it up, the automated updates. You know, probably always a bad idea, but if you talk to the people that insist on automatic updates, they point to Experian, somebody like that, that didn't update their Apache servers, and kerplooey, you know, everybody got in there. It was a wide open door. So, you know, it goes back and forth about what's more secure and what's the better approach, but definitely relying on one only off the shelf commercial software to do these kind of critical systems, probably not a good idea. Hello, Sky News people out there. They got really shut down.
Let's get to an optimistic topic.
Yeah.
And John, let me just kind of tee this up because you brought this up. And, you know, I tend to be, when it comes to technology, much more optimistic about the potential for innovation. Actually, Stuart, you and I talked about it on the interview that we chatted about your series of articles that you're writing about innovation. And, you know, but I think it's a fair question, John, that you've raised, because this was your topic. Are we in a bit of an innovation drought? As you know, and everybody's talking about AI and the amount of investment that's gone into it. And, you know, all the PC companies, Apple, they've all completely pivoted to this as the next big thing. I think, John, you pointed to a study that says that, you know, when you kind of cut through all the noise and all the hyperbole, there really isn't a single AI thing that has proven itself to be essential yet that has changed people's lives. Now, that might be a bit debatable, but, you know, I think it's worthy of discussion. So what's your perspective? Are we in an innovation drought right now?
It does feel like we're a little bit of an innovation drought where we're kind of grasping at different ideas, you know, the goggles and VR stuff that no one is going to wear. We keep trying that, you know, until we just like beat it to death, but no one's going to do that. You know, maybe someday when we have like light glasses that we wear, that'll make it possible. The AI thing is really interesting. It is, there's been so much hype, and there's a Deloitte report and there are some others coming out, you know, looking at the value of it. And they all point out basically that there's no killer app. And that's probably, so you're going to see the next hype wave is going to be bashing AI, of course, because then there'll be report after report about that. It is really, really useful in healthcare in some basic applications that have been out there for years in terms of imaging and diagnostics. There's no question about that. It's a very helpful diagnostic tool. But in, you know, planning your next trip, I wouldn't do that unless you want to show up at buildings that are already closed, which I've done several times in trying that. So it does feel like there's a bit of a drought. I mean, we're going to talk about two other topics, you know, one about smartphones. Again, not much really happening in a lot of years. Laptops, AI laptops, probably not much of a thing either. And when we come to Rob's topic, I think that might finally be taking off. But it does feel like we're waiting for the next big thing.
Well, you know what, Rob? It was kind of interesting, and you'll laugh at this. I saw an article yesterday. There was a developer with an Apple Vision Pro developer, and apparently he came up with an app or some type of gesture in the app that allows you to use your eyes to open your garage door or turn the lights on.
Yeah.
And to me, you can make a few jokes here, and I'm sure that Rob will do that. But you know, spending $3,500 on a headset so I can use my eyes to open my garage door, you know, that kind of, I think that kind of, you know, builds the case for the bright shiny object thing. That is this really what innovation is all about?
And I want to do this.
Technology to help people with ALS, then it's worthwhile. But you know, the $3,500 general interest VR headset is just a contradiction in terms, that entire phrase.
Right. But I mean, what is your viewpoint in terms of the whole innovation drought issue? Because I could argue, because I deal with, you know, big companies like Qualcomm and Intel and Microsoft, and like, as you guys do, and they, you know, Qualcomm, for example, would absolutely say, hey, no, there's no innovation drought. We've done a tremendous job on these new SoCs that are completely reinventing how portables are utilized with AI capability. And then maybe the applications haven't kicked into gear yet, but from a hardware standpoint, they would argue that they've done a tremendous amount of work in very useful technology that is going to reshape the way we use laptops, for example, not just smartphones, but laptops. So are you a non-believer that we're in this kind of innovation drought atmosphere?
No, I think we have not stopped inventing things. Just right now, there's a lot of effort being wasted, I think, on things like AI in ways that don't actually solve people's problems. Like, I don't think we need AI to create new things. AI has a lot of potential to help make more sense of the data we already have. You know, my favorite use case is just tell me, looking through all these emails, what are the meetings I should think about booking for the Black Hat Information Security Conference 2 weeks from now, sometime in August, when it will be painfully hot as the surface of the sun in Vegas, it's a pain to do this by hand. I think there's a lot of interesting work being done in terms of, can we get a lot of these computing tasks done without hoovering up so much data and keeping it around forever, which, as we saw with AT&T, yields all kinds of problems when you keep an enormous stash of data in a place where it can be stolen. But if you can get insights from that, privacy preserving technologies, there is a lot of good stuff happening. Apple's working on it. Google's working on it as well. I think last month I finally got the notice on my phone. My Google Maps timeline is now stored end-to-end encrypted on my device. So there's no more database that somebody else can turn over with a warrant if somebody goes looking for my whereabouts. And that's good. It took some work, and you know, I still get the benefit of that data, but nobody else does. I like that.
Now, Stuart, you and I chatted a couple of weeks ago about the articles that you're writing about those, and you specifically focused in on the topic of something that's innovative. That's a very high bar. You know, I mean, you know, printing press type of stuff, the invention of the telephone, you know, technologies that stay with you, you know, I mean, the invention of the wheel. I mean, I'm really going back a long way, but you know, the industry that we're all involved in tends to be very bright, shiny object oriented. Something that might be innovative to an engineer, that might be in a very narrow sense, is not necessarily game changing. So what's your perspective on this issue?
Well, I don't think we're in an innovation drought at all. And I think that we are clouded by the fact that we're inside the tech bubble, and we're all veterans of this tech bubble, and we've all experienced introductions of major pieces of technology that last 20 to 25 years and then fade. I tend to think of where we are now is in a very fecund gestation period. Sort of like where we were in the late 70s with the home computer, when most of the consumer electronics or tech industry could not figure out why a consumer would ever want a computer in their home. Sometime in the late 80s, when the internet and AOL first started coming up, people were questioning what the hell the internet was and what value it would have to me. It took more than 20 years between the invention of the digital camera and the digital camera actually getting into people's hands. So we are in a very big period of gestation. You've been talking about AI and waiting for the killer app. I think that's exactly correct. AI is in a 1.0, 1.2 gestation period, just like the home computer was, where everybody was sort of waiting for the killer app. And once everybody started to realize what the computer could do at home, and a lot of it was simply the idea of WYSIWYG, that what you saw on your screen was what you got, and allowed people at home to create flyers and posters. Something as simple as that. Samsung earlier this year introduced AI in all its phones, and you have seen a cascade of smartphone makers beginning to add AI to their devices. Every single major, like Apple introduced Apple Intelligence, we'll see in the fall. Oppo is adding it. No, they're all creating partnerships with OpenAI and with Microsoft and a lot of these other companies. This is the first wave of this.
Right.
And so I think that we have to wait to see killer app and how these varying companies and their varying individual software applications really build up. You have the EV car revolution, which is still in its very early stages. They're building out infrastructures. The car makers are all in on it. We haven't yet really seen it blow out to its true potential. We were talking on via email between the three of us about what's going on in outer space and the privatization of space and the innovations that are coming from the development of space travel to the point where space tourism is probably not that far off for less than billionaires, essentially. And the fact that we are now renewing all these talks about going to the moon and Mars again and try to get outside our solar system or outside our planetary system in order to find things and to develop new technology to do that. And as we all know, space technology definitely trickles back down to Earth in many ways, shapes, and forms. So I think there's a lot of innovation going on right now. It's just that, one, it's still in the developmental stages. Consumers aren't yet seeing it. And I think the important word here is yet. We are in a gestation period that I think is going to explode within the next 5 or 10 years or so.
Well, I cannot wait until you actually become the first space tourist, Stuart.
If I live that long.
Now, you're the perfect guy for that. Now, let's get to a topic that actually goes to the innovation topic we've been talking about. You know, foldable smartphones are not yet a thing. If you define a thing based on market size and market appeal, Samsung, of course, has really bet big time on this category. Apple is nowhere to be seen except rumors about them patenting certain of their kind of their capabilities. But you know, that's not really a leading indicator of where they may be going. The hinges are getting better in terms of durability and things. But Stuart, let's talk about it from your perspective in terms of, do you really think we're at a point where, hey, you know what? You know, foldable smartphones are going to be a thing, or will it take an Apple to get will they have to get into the category to validate it for many people?
I think that is correct, but I think we have to know where we are right now. Again, the word yet comes into play. In Q1, the first quarter, January through March, foldable sales went up 49%. You just had Samsung just introduced the new flip phones. Xiaomi just this morning introduced two new models. They're not going to be in the U.S. About a month ago, Motorola released two lower cost foldable models. And on August 13th, Google will be releasing at least one new foldable model. And so you're seeing almost all major Android phone makers have produced foldables. Now, a lot of the Chinese makers are sequestered right now in China, and Huawei is right now the leading seller of foldables. They overtook Samsung. But again, just like we were talking about the innovation gestation period that I think that we're in now, I think the same thing goes for foldables. I think we're in the same period we were in about 2009, 2010, 2011, where smartphones were concerned, where they were really expensive and very few people could understand what they were going to do with them. And now we all know what smartphones have done in the meantime. As we are in this early adopter gestation period for foldables, the battery life has improved dramatically. The hinges, as you mentioned, are improving dramatically. And a lot of the manufacturers are playing with form factors to see which work in the marketplace. For instance, TCL last week, I think, or 2 weeks ago, showed at a conference in San Jose, a tri-fold phone that gave you almost an 8-inch screen when folded out. I don't think they're anywhere near of releasing it, but the fact that we're still in this early adopter gestation period should not say, it's only sold this many units so far, therefore it will never take off. I think it's the biggest mistake that we all make when trying to forecast what technologies are going to take off, which they don't, because almost every single disruptive technology that we've seen in the history in the last 100 years has started out this slowly, with a couple of notable examples such as television, has been through a gestation period before finally taking off and becoming ubiquitous.
Right. So Rob, the innovation thing in terms of the foldable component of the discussion, for it to become a thing, you know, and I think I agree with many observations that Stuart's made, doesn't it require, though, a complementary or a call it a complementary piece on the software side, that when I have a foldable design, that somehow that foldable design allows me to do things I couldn't do with a non-foldable design. Now, Apple's pretty good at that. And in all fairness to Google and Android, there are some usage models with flip phones that are foldable and other designs that they show off. Oh, by the way, if you have a foldable phone, you can do these things with apps that you couldn't do with a non-foldable phone. But will it take an Apple to kind of show the way, show the world that, hey, by the way, if you want to spend the additional dollars, because right now foldable phones are a premium type of device. They are not.
They're in the rub.
Yeah, so go ahead. Yeah,
I think it is not just a question of are the hinges better, are more companies getting into it? Will Apple make one? If the price is going to be more than the cost of a phone and a tablet,
which they will,
something that most people have to replace every 2 to 3 years, and which is has the single highest odds of getting damaged through a fall of any kind of gadget we use, like, I still have no interest in buying a foldable phone. Like, I'm just not going to spend the cost of a laptop on a phone. And yeah, the brand name on it is not going to change that. As far as like, what sort of that apps would you use? I mean, there's lots of interesting things. Google has added a feature where if you flip open a Galaxy Fold, Pixel Fold, whatever, you can run Google Translate. And so one side has, each side shows whatever language the person on it needs. That's good. That's something you can't do with a regular phone. It's also not something most people do every day unless they travel as much as JQ, for sure. You were in Berlin last week?
Yes, right, exactly.
So I remain a skeptic on this category. And while I think in some cases Apple's needlessly cautious, put a touchscreen on a laptop already. I don't think they're crazy for not wanting to get into the foldable phones market.
Yeah.
So John, being the resident billionaire in the group, that's Mark's joke for the morning. I mean, are you a believer that the foldable is going to be a thing? You go to all the same events we do. You get briefed by the same vendors.
Yeah, I keep flashing on this episode of iCarly where she was walking around with a Fablet, like this giant phone to the ear, and they were making fun of it. I mean, even the kids were making fun of it.
I got
to
take this call.
Yeah, we're kind of there with the foldable smartphones. Look, I see lots of our colleagues walking around with them, but those are the only people walking around with them. I just don't see.
Well, and let me say one thing. The people that you see walking around with them in our circle are people who have been given the phone as a
right.
They haven't spent two grand on it.
Right, exactly. And I'm with Rob. I just don't see the use case for them. I mean, I do like a bigger phone when I'm traveling because I want to walk around. I've been in Stockholm and Copenhagen recently and other cities that I'm not familiar with, like Tallinn, and I have the map there. And it's pretty helpful to have that kind of navigation. But still, I just think it's just a variation on what we already have. And it's just kind of a little interesting, but I think what we really want is something that everybody really just tore to pieces when the first one came out, and that's humane. That button you have on you, something like that. I don't want a smartphone anymore. I've had a smartphone, been there, done that. I don't want to reach my pocket for this thing all the time or drop it or be afraid I'm going to drop it. Something like that. When they get something like that working, right, that I think would be a big change. And that was just those poor guys, first generation, but wow, people were brutal on that product. But I think 5 years from now, something like that is going to happen.
And we got to get the next topic because we only have a few minutes left here. But, you know, the foldable capability is also a feature attribute that could extend to portables and laptops. There are several vendors out there with laptops that have foldable displays. Lenovo's done that. HP's got that. They have been very, very – they haven't driven a lot of sales. And, by the way, they're very expensive, you know, in terms of – so we'll see how it happens. Last topic we got to get to because I – love technology. Rob, I give you an award. I want to give you a medal next time I see you that you actually was apparently brave enough to get into one of these robo-taxis. You know, they're even in Las Vegas, by the way. Obviously, when I lived in the San Jose area, they were all over the place, but they're very prevalent out here. What's been your experience? Did you...
Really positive. So I was in LA. I had a day and a half to kill around Los Angeles. And so I thought, well, clearly I need to try out Waymo since it's not available. They're in the very earliest stages of testing in DC. And it was pretty great all around. You know, I found the Waymo driver to be very cautious, courteous, even almost courtly in its willingness to stop for any pedestrian, any cyclist. Even one case, there was a city bus blocking most of the view of the crosswalk, but it still figured out that there was a pedestrian there. And that's because this thing is festooned with LiDAR sensors, radar and everything. So it has a very good field of view. They have in general been super cautious. They have been sort of the opposite of Uber and certainly Tesla, where, you know, to some degree, people find them annoyingly slow in rolling out the service. It was, to my surprise, competitive with Uber before tip. And I got to add, you know, not that I mind tipping people for good service, but not even to think about that is nice. It's also nice when you get into a Waymo, you know, there will not be 2 pounds of air fresheners on the dashboard. The radio will not be tuned to some annoying right wing bozo.
that would count me out because I wouldn't want to get into that robo-taxi.
Yeah. You know, you also lose the ride hail service drivers who are really good conversationalists, as I realized when I had, you know, some of my other drives outside of Waymo service area in Southern California.
But Rob, the one thing you didn't mention, did you go on a highway?
Did not. So right now they're only doing testing on highways. I think they're starting that in Phoenix. Obviously that's going to be a tricky thing because Waymos are programmed to drive the speed limit and on city streets, which hopefully it's kind of self-enforcing, but you know, if you're on a highway like the 405 in LA and it's not gridlocked, if you drive the speed limit, you might annoy a whole lot of people. So that's going to be tricky. Their service area itself is limited, so I could not get picked up from LAX. Right now it goes from downtown LA, sort of arcs through mid-city, south of Wilshire Boulevard and Santa Monica Boulevard to Santa Monica and a little bit of Venice. So there is that. And there can be issues where there are just not enough cars. I had one cancel on me within a minute of showing up in downtown LA. And the next one was a 20-minute wait. I thought, well, for science, I'll do this, even though clearly I should have just gotten on the subway at Union Station and spent a whole $1.75 in 5 minutes. But I care about my readers. So that makes me more optimistic about this potential. But think about what it took to get here. They have the apparently infinitely deep pockets of Google behind them. They've been going at this for years and years and years, and now they have service open to the general public in Phoenix and San Francisco. LA is a wait list. Austin is employee-only testing. So it's a really slow process. And so I don't think this is going to revolutionize driving anytime soon.
Well, and the other piece, Rob, I just wanted to quickly address, from a cost standpoint, were the complimentary rides that you were given or?
Nope. Paid for everyone. So that's what I said. I actually checked costs for Uber and Lyft, and it was right around the ballpark for plain Uber X or regular Lyft, not like a priority pickup or anything, which is a surprise. But I'm also pretty sure that right now Waymo is losing lots of money. The other bets category of Alphabet's income in the last quarter, they lost about over $1 billion. And most of that, my understanding, is Waymo. But they don't really have competition. Amazon owns Zoox, GM owns Cruise, which has had more setbacks. They just had to take all their cars off the market in San Francisco. Uber's given up. I think in general, my experience of this is I'm more optimistic about automated mobility in defined sectors and use cases. You can do taxis on city streets. Maybe it's long haul trucking only on highways, but your all-purpose car that does level 5 autonomy, you can go anywhere under any conditions and there never needs to be a human. We're not there. We're going to have driverless buses. We already have driverless trains. That's a much simpler problem to solve for way before we have automated cars that, you know, make human drivers that obsolete.
Stuart, do you have the guts?
My gut reaction is I'm not sure where the improvement is over what we have. I mean, one of the things that in tech history is that a new technology should improve upon what we already have. And I'm not sure how a driverless vehicle for this sort of thing for taxis as opposed to everybody else improves upon human driven taxis. I'm not sure where that improvement or the convenience factor is.
So
the second thing is obviously, again, gestation period. We're still in the very beginnings of this technology. So perhaps an added plus that the technology brings that the human doesn't may come into play. Like a human being will tell you, I don't take credit cards because they want to take cash. Well, the car can only take the credit card, you know, and they'll never turn you down, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, but I'm trying to wrap my head around where the convenience plus is for the technology replacing human taxi drivers. And I'm missing something. I just don't see where the improvement comes that would say to people, oh yeah, let me take a driverless one because it does something better.
Oh wow. Well, better.
And guys, we only have a couple of minutes left here. John, I just want you to kind of conclude here. Yeah. Is that my first reaction, which is why I asked Rob the question about cost. Now, putting the infrastructure piece of a topic aside, obviously big investments to see if this stuff is even practical. You know, you pull a human being out of the equation, you know, presumably you could lower the cost per trip. So that might answer Stuart's question in that, hey, if a robo-taxi cost is, you know, I throw a number out there, 25% less than a standard Uber ride, well, there might be something there. So what do you think, John?
Well, I think I've lost count at 30. So I've been in more than 30 rides in autonomous vehicles, and most of those without anybody in the front seat. Now, granted, experimental, absolutely experimental. I just did another in the UAE. They have, you know, their own little taxis going around there too. And they do still drive like, you know, Grandma Moses, no question about it. But I think they are the wave. It's just that if they're rules based, they're going to drive slowly and they're going to be like grandma. And so the trouble has always been with the AI stuff. Trying to apply AI has been a nightmare. And that's probably the sticking point with most of this. But the safety factor, you know, granted, Tesla doesn't have the hardware to do an autonomous vehicle, but everybody else that does, super safe compared to drivers. I just had somebody, a driver, taking me in a Lyft. Not only did he miss the terminal and then like back up, do one of those in huge traffic, super scary. And then he missed the departures and he drove when I pointed out, he drove over all the cones and the stanchions. Yeah, exactly. So I've had a number of those. I've had drivers falling asleep, taking me to JFK and like drifting off the highway. I mean, just stuff that never happens in a robo-taxi, not in any of the 30-plus drives. So I'm just saying there is that benefit. It's going to be out there. Rob's right, though. It's taken a long time to get there. And Waymo is the leader by far. So we'll see how quickly they can roll it out there.
Well, I pledge to you that next time we have a podcast, I'm going to take a robo-taxi ride. Just
you should. Do it. Absolutely.
I'll just take a taxi. We can all jump in and do the podcast from it.
Yeah, exactly. I'll put my $3,500 Vision Pro headgear on. That way I don't have to look outside. Well, guys, again, listen, thanks for taking the time and joining me for today's podcast. For our viewing and listening audience, thanks for making the Smart Tech Check podcast part of your day or commute. please make sure that you hit the like and subscribe buttons at the end of today's podcast, or use these convenient on-screen QR codes to connect with me. You can also follow me on X at Mark Vina Tech Guy. And until next time, have a great week. And guys, thanks a lot.
Thank you.